I'm Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNEF podcast. So last week, on the 22nd and 23rd of April, U.S. President Joe Biden invited 40 world leaders to a summit to discuss the climate crisis. So on today's show, we've asked BNEF's Global Head of Policy Research, Victoria Cumming, to join us alongside Ali Izadi Najafabadi, Head of Asia Pacific Research for BNEF. Vicky's with me here in London, and Ali is in Seoul, so we're trying to bring some different perspectives from different parts of the world. They're going to give us a summary of some of the main things that happened at the summit and put it into context during what is looking like a big year for dialogue and commitments on climate with the UN Climate Change Conference, or COP26, approaching this upcoming November in Glasgow. Among the reiteration of some existing commitments, there were a few new commitments and a few statements that bring us a step closer to understanding what some countries will actually be doing. Now, remember the five W's: who, what, when, where, and why? Those are increasingly well-trodden territory when we're talking about climate, but it's really the how, that last question that doesn't fit with the five W's, that is turning out to be the really tricky part. Now, as a reminder, BNEF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and you can hear a more complete disclaimer at the end of the show. But now let's talk about the Biden Climate Summit from last week. Vicky, Ali, thank you for joining today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
So we're here today to talk about the climate summit that took place at the end of last week. So it was a two-day summit that the United States facilitated. There is a notable climate summit already happening this year. So COP26 is coming up just in November. And it really got me thinking when they announced that the summit was going to be taking place, what were they hoping to achieve and what did they achieve potentially? We'll get to that. What were they hoping to achieve at this summit that wasn't already going to be happening at COP in November?
I think we can say that there were two main aims of the event. So the first one is that the US is back in Paris, is back in the Paris Agreement. So it was a chance for the US to reestablish itself, to say, here we are committed to tackling climate change, and we're raising our climate ambition. And then at the same time, so we do indeed have COP26 at the end of this year. One of the reasons why it is an important COP is that it's the beginning of this cycle that was this kind of reporting, pledging cycle that was agreed in the Paris Agreement, where countries or parties, they make their pledges. Then there's a kind of comparison of all the targets together, known as the global stocktake. And then on the basis of that assessment, parties are meant to increase their ambition. And so this summit was an opportunity for countries to make more ambitious pledges. That was the aim, was to kind of galvanize efforts towards tackling climate change. So those were the main goals of the summit. But yes, it may be a different matter as to whether they were actually realized.
There's some pre-COP energy here and trying to get everybody really ready for what will hopefully be a year very much focused on these issues. Were there any countries noticeably absent from the Biden Climate Summit?
From my perspective, actually, it was noticeable about how many countries did attend. So even countries or leaders that have been less than ambitious about tackling climate change or vocal about the need to tackle climate change, say Saudi Arabia or Russia or Turkey, they were all there. So we had Putin, Bolsonaro, Erdogan, AMLO, Mexico was there. They weren't necessarily making more ambitious pledges, but they were certainly in the room.
I think the only country among top 10 emitters that was missing was Iran, and that's naturally expected why he wasn't invited. The only other major economy that was not, the head of state was not invited, was Thailand for obvious political reasons. But Thailand did have representation at the event with having a minister attending.
So we have a tremendous turnout, not a ton of new commitments, but definitely everybody thinking about the year ahead, but a few new commitments that were definitely notable. So why don't we go through those?
Sure, absolutely. So probably the one at the top of the list would be the US's new emission reduction target for 2030. So this is as part of its NDC, that's its nationally determined climate plan. So all parties have to put together these climate plans covering the next decade or so. And they announced their new target, which was a certain amount of step in the right direction. We estimated that if the US had, say, maintained the same level of ambition as its 2025 target and it just extended it out to 2030, then the target would have been in 30-something, about 38% reduction below 2005 levels, whereas what they actually proposed was 50 to 52%. So it is a step in the right direction, yes, but then, which we may want to talk about later, there's a question mark as to its actually achievability. So another one that actually put forward a new target was Japan, but I'll hand that over to Ali.
Thank you, Vicky. So in the case of Japan, the original target was to decrease emissions by 26% in 2030 relatively to the 2013 basis. And this time around, the Prime Minister, just in the run-up to the summit, announced that they would increase the target to 46% emission reduction by 2030 relatively to 2013. There had been a bit of a debate in Japan around what to set the new target at. The Minister of Environment apparently wanted to increase it by reduce the emissions by 50%, whereas the Ministry of Industry had been arguing for 39%, and they were expecting that anything beyond that would be too challenging. And it appears that the Prime Minister has basically gone with the average of the two to keep both sides happy.
Well, and then we've got one more country. So as we're listening here, you know, Ali is representing APAC as head of research for APAC for us, but also you are Canadian. So what is it that the Canadians committed to?
Well, actually, maybe I'll first let Vicky explain that, and then I would be very happy to comment on the Canadian target.
Okay, well, let's see. Well, so Canada, yes. It wasn't a big surprise that it announced a higher target because it has historically aligned itself with the US. So with Biden having announced his 50 to 52% target on 2005 levels, Trudeau announced that Canada was increasing its target from 30% reduction on 2005 levels to 40 to 45%. Now, in comparison with, say, Japan and the US, we would say that this was a less ambitious move. We've recently published a report that compared the G20 countries' NDC targets based on four metrics. So it's really tricky to compare these targets because countries use different deadlines and different baselines. So we use four different metrics, say the reduction in absolute volumes, the reduction in emissions per capita, and we also looked at emission intensity. And on this basis, the new Canada target is not that bold. In particular, if we compare what emissions would be with the target and without the target, we actually found that Canada will be able to substantially increase its emissions and still achieve its 2030 target. So on that basis, it was slightly disappointing. But I understand that Ali may have a different view.
Well, this how we measure emissions keeps coming up again and again, because not only is it very much relevant to the targets that we're setting and whether or not we can compare apples to apples across countries, but you see it across countries and how they're reporting. Previous podcast, but we talked about the EU taxonomy and how they're trying to standardize this here. So this is definitely a challenging space, and it does depend on how you look at it. So Ali, how are you looking at the commitments that Canada made?
To be fair, all these countries are looking at greenhouse gas emissions as a whole. They try to do a very good job of accounting for different types of greenhouse gases, and the conversion factors that they use are fairly consistent. So from that perspective, when they're talking about these emission reduction targets, they are talking about the same thing. Where I think it's important to recognize is, what do they need to do? So where is the emissions is coming from, and what exactly do they have to do to be able to reduce this? And where US is today is very different than where Canada is and where Japan is. In the case of Canada, a significant portion of the emissions is coming from its oil and gas sector. So if you look at regionally, The province of Alberta alone accounts for over a third of Canada's emissions. And if you ignored Alberta, Canada's emissions are already actually declining at a rapid pace. So the challenge that Canada is going to have with reducing its emissions aggressively is how does it get under controlled emissions associated with oil and gas production? Unlike Japan and the US, Canada's power sector is already fairly clean. Over 80% of the electricity is generated from zero emission sources dominated by hydro. So that opportunity of reducing emissions in the power sector is no longer available to Canada because they've already mostly done it. In the case of Japan, actually most of the opportunity is still in the power sector. So the emission factor for Japan's power generation is still relatively higher compared to Europe, US and Canada. So there's a lot of work that they could do to be able to get emission reduction from there. A different way of looking at this is what's the cost of abatement. So how much does it cost you to be able to reduce that emissions? If you're talking about the power sector, the technologies are fairly known and the cost of abatement in the power sector is actually fairly low. In some cases, it can be even positive. So if you're a country like Japan, where you have a very high import dependence on energy, you can potentially, by relying on domestic renewables, you can actually end up having a positive economic impact. But if you have to actually abate existing economic activity, such as oil and gas production, that can be very expensive, particularly given that today we still don't have commercial, available, viable carbon capture and storage technology.
So Ali was impressed. Vicky?
So I would just say I'm not disagreeing at all with what Ali says. It will be tough. It will be tough for all three countries to decarbonize, and for different reasons. But purely on the basis of level of ambition, I think the Canada's step up was slightly lower than, say, the US and Japan. So, I mean, if we are looking at achievability, the US target is going to be very, very challenging to actually achieve. As you say, in theory, the power system will be decarbonized by 2035. So Biden has announced a separate target for that. But then, in terms of looking at how to decarbonize building heating, is very challenging as in industry, and it really does lack the policy support both at federal and state level for that to happen.
Let's talk about that for a second, the US's role in this. So they're making much bigger commitments to climate during this administration as compared to the last administration. So the last administration saw the United States pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and now we have the US back in. How are the other countries making commitments or perhaps not making commitments, viewing the US's role in the commitments they're making now, given that they may very well be reversed in less than 4 years' time?
It's a fair point. The US was in some ways successful in rebuilding some of its credibility with this summit and with the announcements it made. But that target hasn't been passed through into legislation, passed through Congress. And really, it won't be able to kind of solidify its credibility fully until it's put in place the concrete policy measures to achieve those targets and actually taken steps towards meeting that target. So, I mean, one of the reasons why it was so simple for Trump to exit the Paris Agreement was because it hadn't been enshrined in legislation. So it'll be interesting to see if and what steps Biden takes to change that.
One other area that's notable is the amount of money that was committed or maybe not committed to tackling climate change in countries outside of the US and specifically some developing countries. Can we talk a little bit about how much was raised and whether or not that was impressive or not impressive?
The final amount is not super clear. So the US did make a pledge to increase more than $5 billion. But if you want to tally up all the announcements during the summit, it's a little bit unclear. There were a couple of bilateral new partnerships also announced, for example, between US and India and US and Japan. And the US and Japan one was interesting because they also said that they would focus this on the Indo-Pacific region. So it wasn't completely clear. If we go back to climate change negotiations, developed economies had already made the pledge that by 2020, they would increase climate finance support to developing economies to $100 billion. It doesn't appear that they have met that target unless you start counting private investment as well, which is something that was not supposed to be counted towards. So this was supposed to be coming from governments and multilateral entities. The other issue is that there's a bit of a mismatch between countries who have been recipients of this funding versus the ones that have asked for the funding. So places like India and some parts of Southeast Asia have done relatively well. But on the other hand, a lot of the lower developing economies, for example, parts of Africa, have not done as much in attracting the financing that they had requested. The summit, it may have been a positive small step towards that issue, but it didn't seem to bridge the gap. We did have several countries during the summit, starting with the biggest one, China, pointing out the fundamental principle of common but differentiated responsibilities in climate change negotiation. So this is the whole idea that if you look at a challenge of emissions, we have to look at who has emitted since the Industrial Revolution and since European countries, as well as North America and Japan. So basically mostly OECD members, they have been more responsible for emissions historically. They bear the responsibility of helping non-Annex I countries reduce their emissions, and they have to sort of carry the load at the beginning. This is a tricky one because while yes, if you look at cumulative emissions, it's true that those countries bear responsibilities. But if you look at who's emitting more these days and who's on a growing trajectory, then a lot of these non-Annex I countries are becoming an issue.
I mean, this has been a debate for some time as to how we go about figuring out who needs to do what and when and back and forth. Yeah, this is a bit retro in terms of the emissions discussion, but it's back again and they are making strides. So actually, while China didn't create a new target that they committed to during this summit, what was it that they did outline and make a little more transparent?
A positive announcement from President Xi was committing to achieve coal peak consumption within the 15th five-year plan period. That refers to 2026 to 2030. Previously, China had talked about that the peak would be 2030. What he has now alluded to is that they will be achieving that earlier than that. And we saw an immediate reaction where a lot of the coal companies, those that were publicly listed, actually there was a negative reaction to their prices. And there's now a lot more talk by state-owned entities in China around how they can achieve peak coal earlier and try to reduce emissions from coal generators. So that was definitely a positive step.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Let's talk about some of the other interesting things that came from some of the statements that were made by other countries that have a particularly big role to play in the climate discussion, so namely Brazil and Russia. What were their statements at this summit?
One of the interesting ones came from Bolsonaro from Brazil. So he reiterated that the country would be willing to reach net zero emissions. And he actually brought forward the deadline for that from 2060, which has been previously mentioned, to 2050. But he made it clear that that would rest on substantial support from other countries, specifically developed countries. So where about half of that reaching net zero would be achieved through reducing emissions itself, the other half would be through some kind of forestry offsets to make use of its natural resources. And this is one of the first times that a major economy has announced a net zero target, but put it are conditional on support from elsewhere. And as yet, there have not been any kind of concrete responses from developed countries that they would be willing to do that.
The other one may be interesting was Russia, where President Putin actually talked about getting methane emissions under control, which was rather surprising given Russia's significant oil and gas operations and likely challenges with controlling methane emissions. Methane is a bit tricky because it's actually its impact on warming is much more significant than CO2, although it doesn't last as long as CO2 in the atmosphere. So there's been a lot of discussions around getting better control around methane leaks. And it was quite positive to actually see President Putin bring that up and talk about in a positive manner around how there should be international cooperation on getting that under control.
So there's a sense here that there is some momentum in these discussions and that maybe we will see some really very interesting things take place at COP later in this year. As we look ahead to that, I think one of the things that really has stood out to me over the course of this past year with Project Lightspeed and with the advancements that we've made in vaccine technology is that scientists, when they really put their mind and quite a bit of money behind advancing something, we make incredible strides. Now, in the climate space, there is money being committed. There are targets and years and momentum. And my question is, you know, what does this all mean? What do you anticipate, in particular for the spaces that BNEF covers very closely? So let's say, for example, clean energy and transportation. You know, what do we expect might happen in the nearer term in these areas as a result of some of the announcements at the summit last week?
One of the kind of less covered results from last week's summit was the fact not these kind of emission reduction targets made by the likes of US and Japan, but the announcements made by other countries of these more concrete projects or kind of partnerships or initiatives, for example, between US and India with regard to clean energy. What I would anticipate coming out of the COP26 is more progress made on, say, these concrete initiatives around the energy transition, moving towards clean power and clean road transport. Those are two of the priorities for the UK government, which is hosting COP. And we could see more announcements come out centering around initiatives that already exist, for example, the Powering Past Coal Alliance or the Electric Vehicle Alliances. That is one of my kind of expectations from COP. But the other one is also finance. So while that was, say, a somewhat disappointing outcome of the summit last week, the UK government is committed to discussing this 100 billion a year target when it comes to the Glasgow events, and maybe making more commitments from developed countries for, say, 2025. So we would anticipate more progress being made on that side.
And Ali, what would you say the perspective is regarding the Asia-Pacific region specifically?
So on the APAC side, if you look at power sector decarbonization, it's still relative to North America and Europe, the region is relatively behind, even though, of course, APAC with China, it is the largest market for deployment of renewables as well as their manufacturing. But still, in terms of the emission intensity of power generation, the region needs to accelerate. And I think all in all, what we heard at the summit, even though some of it was not new, it was a good sign that this is happening. So hopefully, way before 2030, we're going to see emissions from the power sector in the region to reach its peak, which would be a positive development. When we go beyond these sectors, though, this is where your vaccine analogy becomes really important. So there are areas such as carbon capture and storage, or hydrogen. In general, when we talk about industry decarbonization, these are areas that significant more R&D needs to happen, but also significant more regulation needs to come into place to signal to investors and companies that at some point these sectors will be covered by significant restrictions. We are seeing those signals primarily in Europe today. We are starting to see those signals elsewhere. So Canada, for example, does now have a fairly stringent carbon pricing mechanism in place. But many other economies, particularly when you look at US, China, India, those signals are still not there. And this is where it will be interesting to see whether US will follow through with some type of a carbon pricing mechanism. China has started this, although they have a carbon trading mechanism operational starting from this year. But the prices are not allowed to, right now there's too much free allowances essentially, and the prices are not rising. So it will be interesting to see whether we see more policy direction that, yeah, by 2030, for example, we'll be looking at covering emissions from petrochemicals, steel, and aviation, as an example. These are what we need to see happen within this decade so that there's enough investment going in these new areas for technology development, as well as then their deployment in the 2030s.
Okay, so let's play the acronym game, since it seems like there are a lot of them. We actually wrote a research note, I believe, at one point that was called Making Sense of the Sustainability Alphabet Soup or something along those lines. So, Vicky, what is an NDC?
So an NDC, if you don't know, because if nothing else, the climate talks really like acronyms. So NDC is one to remember. It means Nationally Determined Contribution. So it's essentially a party's plan for how it intends to reduce emissions or promote climate adaptation over the next 10 to 15 years. There's also a longer term version, which is called a long-term strategy. And that goes out to, say, 2050. And it's where some countries have put in place net zero emission goals.
So, Ali, in relation to Asia Pacific, were there any other statements that were made that you found particularly interesting?
So, there were a few other interesting comments from leaders at the summit. One of those was from Indonesia's President Jokowi. For the most part, he took a positive tone, but towards the end, he did comment that countries should not be throwing trade barriers and negatively commenting on other countries' policies. And this was an indirect reference to EU regulations on restrictions of palm oil exports or palm oil imports from Southeast Asia into Europe, because there are concerns that the palm plantations are essentially causing additional emissions because they're usually done by clearing virgin forest and planting in its place palm trees. The other one that was interesting was Australia. Probably for me personally, it was the most entertaining speech. But in terms of substantive commitment towards climate change, it was also probably the one that was lacking any substance. Prime Minister Morrison had a couple of good lines saying, through technology, not taxation. And also he finished with a line that I'm probably going to mangle here, saying that future generations will judge us not by our plans, but by our actual actions. And he was essentially trying to say that the reason Australia is not announcing any additional more ambitious goals is because it feels like it would be empty words, and it's rather focused on fulfilling its existing 2030 goals, which, by the way, right now they're not on the trajectory to fulfill, and they haven't passed any policy framework to actually make sure that they would meet those 2030 goals.
Vicky, in regard to North America and Europe, what did you find that was stand out other than for the countries that we have already discussed?
Well, in some ways, in terms of Europe, it was the least interesting. And that's principally because they have already made the kind of their big headline grabbing climate announcements. So one thing they could say was that on the day before the summit began, the European Commission, Parliament and Council, so those are the three big EU institutions, had reached an informal agreement on its climate law. And in this climate law, it includes its 2030 emission reduction target, which is a 55% reduction on 1990 levels, and the net zero goal for 2050.
Now, how about companies? My understanding was that there were several large, important companies that were also invited to join these talks. What was their role to play?
The reason those companies were there were primarily as a supportive signal for the domestic US audience. So one thing I would give them really high marks is that they designed this summit very carefully with two audiences in mind. One, the international audience, and the other one, the domestic audience, particularly how do they emphasize the jobs as well as the security, the national security angle of climate change so that they can overcome Republican opposition, that even if they don't get enough Republican support, they can still go ahead with what they want to do and the public would be on their side. And I think they generally did a good job of trying to do this.
So there were three new announcements at this summit, and then some other interesting things that we've already discussed on the show today. My final question to both of you is, so we're going to a betting shop and we're going to put our money where our mouth is. You know, who are you betting on, and which of the three countries, so US, Japan, Canada, do you think are going to meet the targets that they've outlined?
I am going to say Canada. And that is because it's not as ambitious as the other targets. Yes, it's already got a fairly decarbonized power system, but the federal government and some of the provincial governments are showing intention of actually reducing emissions and putting in place policy measures to actually realize their emission targets. And that's the most important thing that governments now need to do. It's all very well coming out with these big announcements of goals, which kind of indicate the direction of travel. But the next and equally important step is to actually implement policy measures to spur this change in real life.
I actually would think both Canada and Japan will meet their targets. For Canada, I still disagree with Ricky that it's easy, but I agree that they've done more in terms of introducing a policy framework, particularly on carbon pricing, which recently the federal government won at the Supreme Court as well. So it's fairly secure legislation now in place. So I think they have a good opportunity to meet their target because that policy framework is already in place. And in the case of Japan, compared to both Canada and US, the central government of Japan is much more powerful. So unlike US and Canada, the local governments in Japan don't have as much power. Now, this could be a good thing or a bad thing. In this case, a particular challenge that both US and Canada have encountered, particularly in the case of Canada, where a lot of energy policies at the provincial level, if federal government has a specific national plan, it can run into challenges of constitutional jurisdiction around whether it can implement it or not. In the case of Japan, the central government has all that power. And also, because Japan still has these areas such as the power sector, where if they really wanted to, the technologies already exist, so it's more of a motivation for implementation, they could actually do it. In the case of the US, I think the challenge is that if you look at where the emissions have trended, now transportation is the largest sector. Decarbonizing that for road vehicles will require introducing new fuel economy standards, as well as potentially revamping and expanding the California ZEV mandate nationally. These are topics that definitely Republican states will oppose and will try to fight the federal government. On the power sector, the challenge for the US is that you have to go beyond just reliance on natural gas. While renewables have accelerated, if the Biden administration really wants to meet its 2035 net zero power goal, then we're talking about phasing out or limiting the role of natural gas in the power sector, which is going to be politically very challenging. That's why I think the US target is actually the most challenging politically to be met compared to Canada's and the Japanese one.
Vicky and Ali, thank you very much for joining. I think it'd be great to have you back in the run-up and maybe even post-COP to see where we got to in this next year.
Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.